You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different with the ESO Network Patreon. The cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 195 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Stargirl, Season 1, Episode 6, The Justice Society, Doom Patrol, Season 2, Episode 2, Time Patrol, and, because we don't have any comics this week, we're going to be talking about Into the Multiverse. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. DC Universe subscribers will get a chance to experience HBO Max at a discounted price. An email was sent out to DC Universe subscribers offering a subscription to HBO Max at the price of $4.99 a month. Now, the regular subscription to HBO Max is $14.99, so you're like saving $10. But the offer is only available to annual DC Universe subscribers. And it also says if DC Universe members cancel their subscription, they'll have to pay full price for HBO Max.
We're nearing the end, man.
Of course we are.
It's happening. I know they're saying it's not happening, but it's happening.
Yeah. So, I was surprised by that, but then, again, not surprised by that.
I'm wondering what the game plan will be, ultimately. I wonder if DC Universe turns into, effectively, just Marvel Unlimited, and it becomes just the comics library. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, assuming the price changes to reflect that, that's not the worst thing in the world, to be honest.
No, it's not. It's probably not something I'm going to subscribe to, but
It's like Marvel Unlimited, where it's not something that I subscribe to constantly, but it is something like I have on and off gotten it, and every time I've gotten it, I've not regretted it because I've got my, like, if you, for Marvel Unlimited, if you do the math in terms of like what the trades would cost you if you buy them, as opposed to what, you know, what, however long you get it for, it almost always pays for itself. In DC Universe, it might not be to that. I know it's not to the same point digital collection-wise, but Unlimited wasn't either. When it first started, it was sparse and sort of piecemeal. And the longer it exists, the more they start to fill it out. And as long as, to my knowledge, you might know better than me, I don't think DC rotates stuff out with the comics like they've done with the other media, right?
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I was thinking they did rotate the comics where they were doing it before, but I don't know if they're still doing it.
So I don't, yeah, I will admit I'm not, assuming you don't do that and you just slowly add and add and add to it, eventually it becomes worth it because, like, it only ever gets closer to being a relatively complete collection. Unlimited now is fantastic because, by and large, I mean, you're going to be 3 months behind the new stuff, but, like, if you want to read something from any point in Marvel history and you don't want to go out and buy the book or find the single issue somewhere, it's a phenomenal resource. And I do think I've said this countless times, but I do think DC Universe can get to that point. And so I wonder if eventually that's just what it becomes, is it just becomes essentially the digital comics library. And I know not everybody will pick it up, but, like, if that's what they become, it's great for what it is, because, like, it's something that I wouldn't get consistently because I'm never going to be consistently reading, you know, old DC stuff, but I would definitely get it from time to time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, especially if there's something older you want to read.
Or if there's some big series, like, let's say you want to get into the Geoff Johns Green Lantern run, but you don't want to go and buy all, you know, whatever double-digit number of trades that you would need to get that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
What a great way to read the whole. That's how I read the entire Spider-Verse saga and a Superior Spider-Man that was before that. That entire thing. That would be quite a bit if I were to buy all the comics for that. I read it all digitally, and it was great. I mean, there's something. Some of those stories were stuff that I really liked. I'd like to own, but I know I'd like to own them now because I read them much cheaper than I had to.
Yeah, we'll just have to keep our eyes on what's going on with it.
Yeah.
All right, up next for DC News, Ray Fisher put out on Instagram about Joss Whedon being abusive and unprofessional on set.
So he also threw out that he was enabled by Johns, and I think the guy's name was Berg, I believe. I could be wrong about that. One of the other producers, which is a little concerning. Who knows what the truth of the story is, right? But like
Right.
when you hear that Geoff Johns might be complicit in that, it's like, uh-oh. It's interesting because then the other producer, who his name is escaping me, I believe it's Berg, but I could be wrong, said that he obviously did not agree with that account, and said that Ray Fisher was upset that he had to say booyah in the movie. Which seems really petty to me. Like that, I believe that that may have been a conflict on set, but just from the, I'm saying petty from the producer, because like that just makes Ray Fisher sound like a crybaby, right?
Right.
Like I don't know. I highly doubt that that's the extent of that story. That's just I that even if that disagreement did happen, it probably did happen. Like I'm sure that's not what he's complaining about. And then, even more interestingly, Kevin Smith talked about it on his podcast that he had talked to. He has no personal knowledge of the situation either, but he talked to somebody who worked on the movie. And according to this person, Whedon was extremely dismissive of Snyder's version the entire time and like really talking down on all of these, in his mind, poor decisions that Snyder was making. And the problem was, is your target audience with that, right?
Right.
Because you're talking down to people who helped make that version of the movie. And so he may not have been, I don't know, we don't know. He may not have been horrible. He might have been, but he may just have been like just completely missed his target audience, where he's trash talking a movie to people that believed in the version of the movie that he's trash talking. So they're obviously not going to be very receptive to that. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's one of those things, like we don't usually talk about this sort of thing, but it's become such a big story for comic books right now. Especially, I think, just because the Snyder Cut is obviously a huge deal right now. Obviously, the product that Whedon put out was not particularly loved by the public, too. So I don't know. It's interesting, and I'm kind of curious to see if we get any more details. Because the other thing, conveniently, is that Fisher didn't, include any more details. So it's one of those things, like you put that out there, but then you don't elaborate on it. It just sort of leaves everybody else to kind of, well, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, and it gets interpreted several different ways.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's one of those things, we don't, we, obviously, you and I have no idea what the truth of the story is, but man, what a mess that the production of that movie was.
Yeah, it was. And I think part of the problem, the major problem was you had two different creative ideas, and with a movie half done, I'm sure he was told to finish it, but he didn't like it, and if you didn't, going into something not liking it, you're going to complain about what happened before and what you don't like. And it just ended up being a big old mess.
Well, and then you and I talked about this, I think, when we reviewed the movie and also leading up to the movie. That was a terrible pick to replace Snyder. Not talking specific, like Whedon's made good movies, don't get me wrong here, but like he's a terrible pick to finish a movie that Scott, or sorry, Zack Snyder's made. You know what I mean? Like those are two very, very different directors with very different sensibilities.
Yeah.
Like, that's not the guy you bring in to finish a Zack Snyder film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, let's just, like, James Gunn, for example, like, let's say he had been the director. Whedon sort of makes sense, right? Like, they're not the same, but they're close, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you could see that working because they both kind of seem to lean a little bit more towards the comedic side. And so, but like, Zack Snyder does not. It's just That was one of those picks that was clearly made by a suit who was like, oh, that guy did Avengers. That made a lot of money. So this is our Avengers. So logically, let's get the Avengers guy. Despite the fact that if you look stylistically, that makes no sense.
Nope. Like you said, a suit didn't know what he was doing.
Yep.
And probably not there anymore.
Or they got promoted. Let's be.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, let's move on to our next bit of DC news. The Arrowverse version of Black Lightning will be making his long-awaited debut alongside Ra's al Ghul and Cyborg Superman as Funko Pops. But don't worry, Cletus, neither Ra's al Ghul or Cyborg Superman are from the Arrowverse, so you don't have to worry about those versions. They're the comic versions.
I don't know, man. The Supergirl version of Cyborg Superman is pretty iconic.
Yeah, won't be sitting on my shelf.
You know, collectors would get it. That's the crazy thing. Like, I don't think anybody else would, but the, like, gotta collect them all people would.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. That's cool. I mean, it makes sense. He's really popular. He's got a cool costume, especially the updated one.
Yeah, the updated one for sure.
I don't know what the Funko Pop looks like. I'm sure, like, it's not going to have, it's impossible for it to have had that weird plasticky look anyway. I mean, it's probably literally made of plastic, but you know what I mean? Like, the real life costume had that, the original one had that weird plastic lightning bolts thing. Like, it wouldn't have had that look. So even a version of that, I don't think would look as weird in Funko form, to be honest.
Apparently you haven't been on our Facebook group in the last few days because it's posted on there.
I had seen the news. I must have just not paid attention to the picture.
It's got a picture of Black Lightning actor and then the Funko Pop right next to it. You'll have to go on there and take a look. All right, for a last bit of DC news, DC Stargirl is renewed for season 2, but only on the CW. Now that's just telling.
I was going to say, just in case you weren't sure from other news that we've talked about, the DC universe is not long for this world. I am very glad that it's getting a second season. I'm not going to lie, though, Drew. I'm really concerned what season 2 is going to look like. Like, is it going to get turned into a normal CW show? Is it going to, you know what I mean? Like,
I don't know. It's Jeff Johns' baby, so.
Yeah, but like, you know what I mean? Like, the budget is almost certainly going to go down, which is going to be bad. That's going to be really bad. I could be wrong, but that would be very inconsistent with everything the CW's ever done for the budget to stay the same. Unless it's also still getting funding from DC somehow, which it probably won't. I don't know. And I hope if it starts being filmed weekly, like the Arrowverse shows, I'm not going to lie, it's going to be a worse show. It will absolutely be a worse show. If it becomes more like the other CW stuff, it will be worse.
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to agree with you on that.
Now, hopefully they won't do that. They will still film it in its entirety. It's not a coincidence that shows like that tend to be better because they are not filmed, like, they're not, the story is written as a whole, and that's not like an evolution of a story where you inevitably get, like, things that don't totally make sense towards the end of the season. When you film something obviously it's not, you know, sometimes you can still have poorly written seasons, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know what you mean.
There's a reason, like, HBO shows, for example, tend to be better than your normal broadcast show. The budget, first off, but also, like, narratively, they're just, like, that's the story.
Just like your Netflix originals. Those are always better, too.
Right. And again, I want to be, like, it's not like those are always great, right? There are always some shows that are bad. But there's just no way. There's if and we don't know that it will, if Stargirl becomes filmed like a normal CW Arrowverse show, it's going to be a worse show, a much worse show.
All right. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
I hope so. I will say I'm really glad it's getting a second season. I'm very much enjoying the show right now. But I'm enjoying it for, like, again, like, how it's, like, it's like the other DC Universe shows, right, where it's a clear, you know, it filmed in its entirety narrative. It's got much better budget than a CW show. Like, all of those things matter. Also, can't believe we're going to be in a world where Luke Wilson is starring in a CW series. It's got to be a low point for him.
All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Check out what's been going on with the Pop Culture Cosmo Show and the PCC Multiverse.
You know how Disney kind of like puts films on an assembly line, but you know that when you're getting something from Pixar, because it takes so long to craft, that there's a lot of care put into it.
That's the Pop Culture Cosmo Show.
And the PCC Multiverse.
Playing worldwide on radio 7 days a week, your favorite podcast app, and right here on the ESO Network.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's DC television shows, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Stargirl, Season 1, Episode 6, The Justice Society. So this episode opens up with Artemis Croc getting a late hit by a boy on her team. And the boy is giving her crap because he doesn't like a girl being on the football team. Artemis punches him and then gets benched by the coach. Then after school, we see the parents confront the coach by killing him. Yes, her parents are part of the Injustice Society, Sportsmaster, and Tigress. All right, we see Courtney comes home from being out as Stargirl, and Pat is sitting in her room in the dark. Pat confronts Courtney about stealing the artifacts from the JSA headquarters, and Pat says he feels betrayed that Courtney has been recruiting JSA members behind his back. And Pat tells Courtney she needs to get all the artifacts back, including the hourglass, the goggles, and Wildcat's suit. Now we see Pat confronts Rick about the hourglass and the damage that he did to his uncle's truck. He gives Rick his father's journal that seems to be in code. Rick has Beth use the goggles to try and decipher it, but Chuck has no match for the equation. Chuck's alarm signal goes off that his arch enemy, the Gambler, is trying to hack into the communications company Empire Enterprises. Courtney wants to tell Pat, but the others vote against it, and the group decides to go out after the Gambler themselves. Now, when the new JSA team goes after the Gambler, they're in for a big surprise, because Sportsmaster and Tigress show up and kick their asses. Now, the battle scene itself was cool and kind of longer than I expected, but the inexperience of the new team I thought was played well in the battle. And if Stripe hadn't shown up, I don't know if the kids would have survived that battle.
One thing I thought they did well, so obviously Courtney is the most adept fighter in that group, which logically shouldn't make sense, right? Because she's had the staff like a week longer than the other kids have got their things. But I think the show did a really good job of showing that it was really like the staff that was doing a lot, and she just kind of knew how to be all along for the ride with it.
Right. They did a lot of, it looked to me like they did a lot of wire work, and I thought that was pretty cool. A lot of wire work and stuff. Other than using CGI and stuff, it looked pretty cool, I thought.
I thought they were really good fight scenes. I really enjoyed them. And like I said, I thought it was clever because, of course, she's the main character. You want to make her the most competent fighter of the group to justify her being the leader. And I thought that they did it in a way that sort of subtly explained why she would be better, right? Because
right.
It was this, like, there were like, the way they had it, you could tell, like, the staff was almost moving without her to block stuff. And it was cool. The only thing I thought was a little odd in that fight scene was when Sportsmaster attaches the bomb to her staff and it goes and flies off. And it tries to give you this moment where, like, oh, did the staff just break? and then it's immediately fine. And it was like, what was the point of that moment?
Yeah, I know what moment you're talking about. I wonder if the bomb kind of interrupted the staff's energy, and maybe that's why it died down for a minute. And then right.
Which is fine. It was the way they played it. Like, that's fine. I think I honestly have no problem with the staff getting shorted out. Sure. Okay. I don't personally know enough about Starman staff to know how accurate or not accurate that is. I don't care. It was the way they played it. They made it seem like the staff was like broken for like 10 seconds.
Yeah, they did. I think they were trying to make the audience worry, but we knew
it was. You got it, but like then leave it. Leave that be the status quo for the rest of the episode. You know what I mean? Because like I barely had time to – I probably would have bought it, Drew, to be honest with you, if they had been like, it's broken. I'd be like, oh, no, because I don't know any better. But they like immediately it fixed itself and it was like, oh, well, what? You know what I mean? Like it was one of those things where like the moment's fine. I honestly have no problem with it. But like if you're not going to do it, then just don't do it. That's what I'm – you know, that's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah. Or they might have been showing us that, hey, it can take it out for momentarily, but it's coming back.
Or maybe they're or trying to introduce the possibility of it happening in the future.
That could be too. Or they just wanted to try to throw the audience off, and it didn't really work like they wanted it to.
Yeah. Well, again, they just didn't. There was no time. They didn't give any time for the audience to digest it. Because like she catches the staff. She's like, oh, no. And then it immediately turns back on. So there's no time for the audience to really be like, uh-oh. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's not that the fake out couldn't have worked. It absolutely could have. They just didn't give it enough time to work to do what it was meant to do.
Yeah. And that could have been an interesting take for the staff to be out for the rest of the episode, not come back till next episode. Because then she'd be really worried about being Stargirl.
Well, and it also, I think it would have been a good choice because it would have reinforced the point that they were absolutely not ready to go do what they did, right? Because yeah. the thing that was weird, so the staff fixes itself and they immediately do the superhero lineup pose.
Right.
Which suggests that they might have been fine. Like, clearly Pat showing up is what gets Tigress and Sportsmaster to leave and ultimately save the kids, but... There's no indication from like as soon as the staff turns back on, there's this sort of an indication that like maybe they'll be fine. Right.
Right.
There was conflicting messages where they like I agree with you. They were clearly losing, but they weren't losing that badly. And I think it's different if the staff breaks and then all this like that was really the only thing keeping the fight somewhat even. Let's be real, was Stargirl and the staff was the only thing keeping them from getting wiped.
Right.
And if you break the temporarily break the staff, and then they're all – the only thing that was keeping the fight equal is now gone, then it's like an uh-oh. And then you have Pat show up. I think that – I don't know. I think it makes that dynamic of that scene a little bit more clear in that Pat saves them.
Yeah. That actually – I actually agree with you. I think that would have made more sense.
Because that's ultimately what they were trying to – I'm not trying to disagree with what they were trying to accomplish. You know what I mean? Like I think ultimately what they wanted was to have Pat show up and be clearly the reason that they didn't die. And I think you make that an easier thing to communicate and becomes an easier like – I don't know. It just – I think it works better if the staff is out of commission when he shows up.
I love the scene when they get back to Pat's garage and Courtney and him are up in the loft talking and she's like, the team's not listening to me and stuff like that. And then it finally dawns on her. That's what she'd been doing to Pat. It was freaking great.
That was good.
And I like the fact that Pat finally realizes, hey, we're going to have to go with this new team, whether we want to or not. So I'm excited because it looks like they're going to move into – I'm guessing next episode we're going to be doing some training with the team. So,
and what's interesting is that this seems like it's the lineup. And I don't know from any like pre-release stuff if that was always supposed to be the case. I think the only other thing that we're going to see is the pen.
Yeah. They keep hinting that at that pen, because they showed it again in this episode. They specifically put the camera on that pen after Pat had taken all the other stuff out of the room. So it's got some sort of importance coming soon.
So Flash doesn't seem like is going to come into factor in this show, this season, at least much. Green Lantern doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
I know. Now, I'm bummed about both of those. Yeah, but that's what it seems like.
Though. I don't know. I'm not shocked by that. But who else is missing then?
Shoot, Pat still had quite a few artifacts.
Oh, Dr. Fate.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, Dr. Fate. And who knows? They may grow the Justice Society more season two also.
Oh, right. Oh, no. I'm not saying that we'll never see those. I'm just saying it seems like this is the team, right? Like,
yeah.
With the exception of that the genie is definitely going to come into play. But apart from that, it seems like this is the team is basically set, which is, I'm fine with. You don't need to go 100%, but I'm trying to think of who else. I mean, like, classically, usually Hawkman and Hawkgirl are involved, but I don't think they were involved in this version of the JSA.
I don't remember seeing them in the first episode.
So. I'm trying to compare it to, like, what the roster that Geoff Johns usually used to comprise the JSA.
Oh, Shazam.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. And which is also a bummer.
Again, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, is it really just Fate, Lantern, and Flash? That seems wrong. I feel like there's something else missing.
I think you're right. I think something else is missing, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
I feel really dumb right now. I feel like there's something really obvious you and I are both missing, and I can't think of what it is.
Don't worry. Somebody's yelling at us right now. somebody's yelling at us at their phone. You guys. So, oh. We'll probably think of it later after we're done with the podcast. So we also see that the gambler is able to gain the codes and the equipment that Dr. Ido requested for the satellite. And unfortunately for the Injustice Society, they need Brainwave in order for Project New America to work. But in the meantime, the villains decide that they're going to find out who the new Justice Society is.
Not only are we seeing the legacy of the JSA passed down, we're definitely seeing the legacy of the Injustice Society also being passed down, because we got another hint, because we learned Icicle's son also has the ice powers.
Oh, yeah. We did see that in this episode.
Briefly hinted at that. We know, and I'm assuming ultimately their solution to replace Brainwave is going to be to recruit his son, who we've seen clearly start to develop those powers.
Yep.
I'm fairly certain that the Mean Girl is going to become something. I don't know what, but I'm almost positive I read somewhere that she's supposed to be some character in the comics. I just don't know who it was.
Yeah.
And then we also know Sportsmaster's daughter, Artemis. I mean, like, that was not very subtle. It's interesting with the naming, because his daughter is the superhero code name Artemis in Young Justice and I believe also in the comics. So will she just be Artemis, or will she become like a Sportsmaster Junior sort of thing? I'll be curious what they do with the daughter too.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. So I'm really liking this show. And I know there's more episodes out than we're caught up to, but I'm really excited about finishing this. And I've had to hold off on both this and Doom Patrol going ahead of where we're at on our schedule.
It's hard to.
It is.
I have to compliment this show. I feel like it's really grown into itself well. I still maintain that the pilot was not the best pilot that I've seen, but I feel like the show's really grown into itself well.
Yeah, and I agree. All right, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Doom Patrol, Season 2, Episode 2, Time Patrol. In this episode, it is confirmed that the amulet Niles gave to Willoughby was needed to extend his life. We already start to see that Niles is growing older very quickly, and Niles even confirms that his age is 139. Niles is becoming desperate to find a solution, and Rita decides to make it her mission. So we see Cliff, Jane, and Rita go back in time to 1980, where Dr. Time exists in a disco roller rink. He possesses a time-manipulating material called Continuum. When Jane goes to steal what she thinks is a helmet, it turns out to be Dr. Time's brain. And then we see all hell breaks loose as historical figures fight over the brain. Rita uses the clock face to reverse time, and Dr. Time expels them from his time capsule roller rink, and the team returns home empty-handed. We also see Cyborg take off, leaving the mansion in this episode. We see him visiting a trauma support group. The group requires Vic to turn off his camera, and he reluctantly does, but he also says it makes him vulnerable. Vic gets to know one of the members after the meeting, and when they leave, somebody attempts to mug his new friend, and as a war veteran, she handles the mugger easily. Vic and his new friend have a quick conversation about whether the cops should be involved, because she wants to give the kid a second chance. Now, Vic eventually sees things her way, and he lets the kid go. We also see Jane struggle this episode with repressing her other selves. We see her continuing to use drugs, but after returning from their failed time mission, Jane relives a flashback where she is continually dunked into water in some twisted baptismal exorcism. Jane talks with some older woman from the underground who states that Jane might have to give control over to Miranda. And I sort of remember Miranda from last season.
I think she was the one, she's the one that got broken by something else. Like, that personality got broken, and that's why Jane had to take over.
Okay.
She was the dominant personality, and then more trauma happened, and it broke Miranda, and that's when Jane had to take over.
Okay. We also see...
I believe that the woman that she's talking to is the, like, lawyer personality that we saw.
Okay.
Do you remember that? The, like, really super serious, stern one?
Yeah, I remember her.
I believe that's who that is.
Also in this episode, we see Larry attend his son Gary's funeral, who's presided over by his other son, Paul, who are much older than him. It was kind of weird, wasn't it?
Now, I mean, Larry... It was, but it also makes sense, right? Like,
yeah.
That is how old they should be.
Yeah, that's true. Larry reveals who he really is to Paul and invites Larry to come over to the reception at Gary's house. Now, Larry couldn't go in, but his negative spirit brought him to Gary's barn full of memories. And when he leaves, we see a swarm of butterflies attack him. And I think that's basically the end of the episode.
That was the end of the episode. What a... Do you know how hard it was, Drew, to not watch the next episode on that cliffhanger?
Yes, I know.
I can't imagine. I'm sure some people do watch it episodically also, but I feel like most people would watch that episode and immediately watch the next one because, well, what a juicy cliffhanger.
Yes.
Oh, I'm dying to... I, as you and I have said, we both watch only up to what we're at of the podcast, not confuse ourselves. Oh my gosh. I really want to know what happens next because that was wildly intriguing.
I know.
Man, that Larry's story was so sad too. Like, it's one of those things where, like, when you think about it, like, of course that's what's happening. Like, he's been out of commission and in this other life. And of course his sons would be this age now. And how would they react to the weird disappearance of their dad? Because they know that he survived, or at least in theory he survived. I'm pretty sure that's public knowledge, right?
I'm pretty sure.
Or semi-public knowledge. The mom definitely, at least at some point, knew that he had at least briefly survived.
Yeah, well, because she came, if you remember, she came and visited him when he was in that room.
Right, and then we don't know, there may have been like a story where, like, he, you know, quote, died, you know, from complications, but like there's at minimum I believe they would know that he at least didn't die immediately in the crash, which is crazy. Like, how does that happen in its of itself? So, like, oh man,
well,
I'm very intrigued by his story right now.
Well, clearly in this episode Gary thought he was still alive.
Yes.
So,
and then, like, do the butterflies have something to do with Gary? Is it is it something unrelated to that? Is it, you know what I mean? Like, is that a different threat? Like, it's so funny too, because they hadn't really, that all of, almost all of Larry's stuff happened in the back half of the episode. And in during, when we were watching the first half, my girlfriend, who is a huge fan of the show also, was like, are they like writing Larry off? Are they not using him much? And then as soon as she said that, they started, they got into the funeral stuff. And it was almost like the show hurt her. I was like, no, no, we got you. We got you. He's still a character.
So, yeah, I'm really interested in seeing where this is going, especially that butterfly scene.
That the disco scene was so funny.
It was freaking hilarious.
Oh my gosh. And the comments, like the writing on this show is just so good. It's like, this is where time, this is where humanity peaked on a in a roller rink off of I-95. God, just, oh man, all that, everything about that was just hilarious. And then just like also perfectly Doom Patrol. I continue to be really highly, highly impressed with how metafictional they managed to make the show. Because that was one of the things I talked about before the show came out, was how are they going to, the comic itself, especially during the Morrison run, which is this almost exclusively based off of, was super metafictional, was very much, you know, like a, you know, them almost like existing in a, like knowing that they exist in a comic book and doing the like typical Grant Morrison stuff.
Right.
And how were they going to do that in a show? And they've like, it's unbelievable how well they've adapted that concept. It's incredible. I mean, it's just, what a good show.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to the return of Danny too. Right now he's just a freaking brick. So
we did get, Victorian era Danny.
Yes,
so that was nice. That was kind of cool.
It was cool. All right, well, that wraps up our DC television talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk the DC multiverse.
Fans of podcast, I am Rusted Robot.
Rusted Robot is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. Episodes in the hundreds, with pop culture reviews and geek-style news. I am Rusted Robot Podcast. You have come here for geek.
Will you listen?
Listen?
For free?
No, we will run, and we will live.
Aye, run, and you'll live, and dying in your beds many years from now. Would you be willing to trade all those days and come back here for just one more listen?
They may take our lives, but they'll never take our Rusted Robot Podcast.
And we're back! Let's talk DC Multiverse! Cletus and I decided to do this as a topic when we found out there wasn't going to be any comics this week. So, one of the things about the DC Multiverse has always been fascinating to me. And I know it has been to you too.
Oh yeah, it's my favorite thing about the DC Universe. And there's so much I like. Obviously, I'm a huge fan, but like, the multiverse is like the thing.
Now, before we get a deep dive into the multiverse, let's define what it is. I know most of you guys out there probably know what it is, but for some of our listeners who may not be into comics as much, let's define what it is. The multiverse is a collection of multiple universes existing in the same physical space, but kept separate by differing vibrational speeds. Now, the multiverse has been around for long time, pre-Crisis on Infinite Earths. In the original DC multiverse, Corona was a member of an ancient race of powerful blue-skinned immortals from the planet Multis. The Multusians would later relocate to Oa and style themselves the Guardians of the Universe. Corona was obsessed with observing the creation of the universe, and despite the Oan legend that said attempting to uncover the secret would cause a great calamity, Corona created a machine that allowed him to witness the dawn of time, and his machine interfered with the process, and terrible consequences created the multiverse. Now, one of the first multiverse stories, the Flash, Barry Allen, accidentally changes his vibrational frequency to match that of Earth 2, where he meets Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash, and his comic book hero. That meeting resulted in years of interaction between the original superhero team, the Justice Society of America, and their younger Earth-1 counterparts, the Justice League of America. And I guess Barry Allen was given the honor of naming the two Earths. So he named his Earth 1 and Jay Garrick's Earth 2.
What's interesting, just from a comics history standpoint, not so much necessarily DC universe with it, like in universe history, is so obviously those Golden Age characters were being published beforehand. And then during the late 40s, a lot of those comics died off. Like, they just didn't sell well. Superman sold extremely well, but really none of the other ones really did. And they all kind of died off. And then in the 50s, starting with Barry Allen, DC started trying to reinvent some of them. And then later, Drew, like you mentioned, they did that first crossover, and it kind of became a like, well, we already had these other versions. Like, what if we kept how could we keep using them? And that sort of kicked off the tradition of crises, so to speak. There used to be, you know, like the first one, I think it was Crisis on Two Earths, was the Justice League and the Justice Society meeting each other fully. Like, we had already seen Barry and Jay Garrick meet. And then we get the two Justice people groups together. And then I believe it's the second ever Crisis, I believe, is the one where they meet Earth 3. And that's where they decide to spin it on its head. Because before, with the Justice League and the Justice Society, I think they end up fighting each other's villains. I've read these before, but it's been a little bit. But the second one is the one that got, I think, is where it started to get really interesting. Because they appear to meet what seems like another Justice League, and it turns out to be the Crime Syndicate. That's actually the first version of the Crime Syndicate, with Ultraman and
Superwoman.
Yeah, all of those. Yeah. And they continue to evolve over comics history. But that, to me, actually, I find that one to be a really interesting moment, because that's when they started to get really experiment. I think that's the first time where you start to see it really kind of experiment with the idea of the multiverse. Right.
Right.
Before, it was really just how can we reconcile the fact that we have two different versions of these characters, and we kind of want to, like, people want to read stories with both of them. How do we do that? Well, that's how you do it. And then it became we have this concept. It's kind of an interesting concept. What can you do with that? What would that look like? What does a multiverse look like? And so, I don't know. Not to geek out too much over, but I just find that one really interesting, because that's really the first time, in my opinion, that DC starts to be like, oh, this is an interesting concept. What can we do with that?
Yeah. And the multiverse stayed around for quite a while until we get to 1985, where they decide to consolidate it back down to one Earth. And that's where we get Crisis on Infinite Earths. A being known as the Anti-Monitor is set free and begins to destroy the different Earths of the multiverse. The Monitor tries to recruit heroes from the multiverse, but is murdered. Brainiac collaborates with villains to try to conquer the remaining Earths. However, both heroes and villains are eventually united by the Spectre, and the series concludes with Kal-El, Superboy Prime, and Alexander Luthor Jr. defeating the Anti-Monitor and creating a single Earth in place of the multiverse. So, in mid-80s, DC decided they wanted to get rid of their multiverse, and they go down to just one Earth. Now, that sticks around for a while until we get to 1994, where we have another crisis, Zero Hour, which is a crisis in time. Now, Zero Hour was a 5-issue limited series, and it was written and drawn by Dan Jurgens. The main storyline featured the destruction of the time stream by the efforts of Parallax, who possessed Hal Jordan. And he was attempting to restructure the universe and correct things that he perceived to be wrong. Now, another supervillain, Extant, took advantage of the chaos and tried to use it to create the world in his own image. And the leader of the fight against them was Wave Rider of the Linear Men. And the conflict resulted in an entirely new Big Bang, which rebooted the entire DC universe with subtle differences. And this served as an opportunity to clear up continuity problems and fix plot elements. And
which is interesting. Sorry to jump in here, but Zero Hour was really interesting because it's the first time where you start to see DC unable to deal with being able to keep its continuity straight. And it's really just the reality of comics publishing. It's never going to happen, right?
Right.
The only reason it worked Early Marvel is the only time that that's ever worked, and it's because Stan Lee was writing everything. You had one dude, you know, almost everything. It's really easy to keep your story straight if it's only one dude writing it.
Right.
Any other time, it's like it can work in short spurts, but it's never going to work long term because you're going to have different writers doing different things and the different writers taking over those stories, and things just start to conflict. They don't match up. So Zero Hour is interesting because, like you said, so Crisis on Infinite Earths was done in part because the multiverse had become sort of such a mess and confusing. DC had never taken continuity seriously, and then Marvel had become so huge they thought, well, maybe we should be taking it seriously. The only way to do that is to basically just reboot into one world. And then they couldn't keep it straight, so Zero Hour happens. And then they couldn't keep it straight, and now you can keep going.
One of the things I want to say that I collected during Zero Hour, one of the things that I thought was cool that DC did is when they right after Zero Hour is over, they started all their titles with a number zero. But instead of starting at issues number one, they went back to the numbering they were doing before. So they'd have the issue zero where you'd get, we'd see the new version of your hero, and then it would go back to the regular numbering. They didn't start over at one like we've been seeing over the past few years, or at least last decade, I guess, where they keep having to start over at one. So they had the zero issues, and then they went back to the regular numbering. I thought that was a good idea.
That's cool. And then another thing, just for people, for the probably minority of our audience that doesn't already know this, Hal Jordan, the Parallax thing, at the time, he just was the villain. That was only retroactively made by Geoff Johns to be something that he was possessed by. But in the moment, he had just basically just turned to the dark side, essentially.
Yeah, because Parallax didn't exist at that point.
Well, he was called Parallax.
Well, yeah.
That was his villain name.
Right.
And Johns basically retconned it to be the name of the essentially creature. Alien parasite possessing him.
So, yeah, because that him going villain was DC's plan at that time.
Yeah, I've said this before, but that story where that happens is the first Green Lantern book I ever read, which I remember finishing it being like, this seems like this was important.
That's funny. I was collecting Green Lantern at that time, so I believe that was issue number 50.
I read it in trade form. It was at the local library. Okay. In Casper, Wyoming.
I actually
they had it on their shelves. I knew I liked the color green. I think I had heard of Green Lantern before, and I was like, "Oh, I'll read this." And it was quite the saga to jump into.
I imagine. All right, next we get another reboot, but this is like kind of like a soft reboot. It's called Superman Birthright, and it happened in 2003. And because of the popularity of Smallville, DC writer Mark Waid and artist Lineal Yu to create 2003 Superman Birthright, a retelling of Superman's mythos that incorporated some of the elements of the television show, and we'd see those woven into the main Superman books over the next few months. And that goes on until we get to the New 52. So, well, actually...
Oh, I was going to say, we should definitely mention Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, that's coming up next. I don't know why I had that going to New 52. So the next reboot we get after that is in 2005, and that's Infinite Crisis and the 52 series. So DC Universe pretty much gets splintered apart and put back together again in a new configuration. But the fact is, there's really no reboots here, but we get significant origins and story markers changed. And we get a creation of a limited multiverse in this, where some of the Elseworlds stories that DC have published are, as imaginary, were given firm places in canon. So Infinite Crisis kicked off what you might call a structural reboot of the DC Universe multiverse.
It sort of created the rules that DC still follows now, was that there was not an unlimited... So Crisis on Infinite Earth, as it would suggest, was an infinite multiverse. And Infinite Crisis restores the multiverse, but limits it to 52. different universes. So there is a specific number that is still the case now. That's not changed.
All right. And our next big event after that is 2011, the New 52. Now, the New 52 is a 2011 revamp and relaunch by DC Comics of its entire line of ongoing monthly superhero comics. Following the conclusion of Flashpoint crossover, DC canceled all of its existing titles and debuted 52 new series in September 2011 with number one issues. Now, I wasn't reading comics during that time. I know you were. It was a big change, wasn't it?
It was. Well, and just a little bit before that too, maybe like a year or two before that, there had been what had been meant to be the next big crisis, Final Crisis, by Grant Morrison. Except I personally like it, and it's going to tie into something that we're going to talk about in a minute with the multiverse. But it wasn't really. It's not the same. Final Crisis is not like the other ones, where it is very much a multiverse story, but it ultimately isn't the continuity shaker that the other ones that in its lineage. In theory, it's supposed to be like the completion of, at the time they sold it as the completion of the trilogy of Crisis on Infinite Earths, Infinite Crisis, Final Crisis. Except that's not the story that Final Crisis ended up being. It's a really interesting book. Hard to understand initially. Well, I think, honestly, one of the reasons I think it's hard to understand for some people is that I think depending on the version that you read, I own a collected version that includes the Superman story. So there was also – Morrison was also doing Superman at that point. And if you don't read those, the end of Final Crisis does not make sense. You have to have read those because the villain ultimately comes from the Superman stories. It doesn't come from the beginning. It looks like it's really about Darkseid, and it is for most of it, but then it shifts at the end and it's about something else. And that seems like it comes out of nowhere if you haven't read those Superman ones.
Interesting.
Anyway, the main point is that it is a multiverse story, but it is ultimately not – it's not like the other two. It's not – it didn't end the multiverse. It doesn't bring back the multiverse. It sort of threatens the multiverse. It becomes more like Scott Snyder's recent Justice League run, right, where it is very much about the multiverse and the fate of the multiverse, but it wasn't the continuity buster, so to speak, that the other ones were, or like Zero Hour was. And I think maybe in part one of the reasons it never became that is because within a year, New 52 happened. And so even the changes that did come out from that really were more from other writers and not from Morrison, the New 52 happened. And that was – it was so interesting because I was reading comics at that point. It was interesting how it all came sort of – if I don't know – I was too young to be paying attention to like what the publishing news side of it was, but from a reading it standpoint and then starting to hear buzz, Johns had gotten so this is going to be weird, but he's got his big Green Lantern thing started with Green Lantern Rebirth, right?
Right.
And then that big run happened. And then they announced that he was going to be doing Flash Rebirth. And for those that don't know, 30, 40 year spoiler, Barry Allen dies in Crisis on Infinite Earths. And he didn't come back. He was one of those ones that was like Bucky or who also didn't change. You know what I mean? Like, he was one of those classic comic book characters that really actually had stayed dead for the most part. In Flash Rebirth, Johns brings him back. And then he said that he had planned on doing, there had never been a big Flash event. So when he brought Green Lantern back, he sort of did a Green Lantern event comic with Blackest Night, and it was hugely successful. And so then he brings Barry Allen back, makes him the Flash again, and he sort of says, I want to do a Flash event. And that initially was like, oh, that's cool. And then all of a sudden it turned into, I don't know the behind the scenes story with this. I don't know that it was initially meant to reboot the DC universe, to be honest with you. Because most of this, it doesn't read that way. It's a massive change because, like you said, it creates the New 52, but it creates the New 52 almost randomly at the end of the story. It's very much just a giant, really cool Flash story that I highly recommend people read. And then right at the end, all of a sudden this Pandora character pops up who became sort of like this mysterious New 52 character that ultimately amounted to nothing. But she pops up and she sort of like is, it appears in the moment, she appears to be responsible for creating the New 52.
That changes.
Yeah, it does change.
All right. You ready to get into the next era?
Yes.
All right. The next era, Rebirth. DC's Rebirth in 2016. Now, this is what I got back into comics because director Faber came to me and asked me if I wanted to do a podcast on DC because apparently I've been doing lots of posts on DC on the Earth Station One Facebook group or something. So, shoot, we were born. And this is when I got back into comics, right when Rebirth was taken off. So, following the Flashpoint event, Wally West became lost in the Speed Force for 10 years. While trapped in the Speed Force, he came to realize that Barry had not been responsible for the New 52 universe, but that an unknown entity had used Barry's time traveling as an opportunity to alter reality. And the fallout of the recent Darkseid War allowed Wally to reach out to his former friends in hopes of either returning or warning them of the truth. Now, Barry starts remembering pre-Flashpoint, and he drags Wally out of the Speed Force. And Wally's presence integrates his pre-Flashpoint history into the new timeline to accommodate his existence, resetting his past and those who are associated with him. We find out that Dr. Manhattan from The Watchmen is behind all of this, and he's created the New 52 and is responsible for Rebirth by erasing all previous history and making this universe. So that's been all the major crises of the multiverse.
Something that people should see, the pattern that we're sort of seeing through all of these, is they're all tied to DC has made a mess of their current publishing situation. And so they use one of these to sort of try and fix stuff and reboot it and reinvigorate the reader base. And sometimes it's really successful. Other times it wasn't. There were some kind of failed ones in between there that were sort of minor reboots that we didn't talk about that, again, one of the reasons they're minor is because they flopped.
Now, the multiverse that we currently have is still the 52 Earths, correct, Cletus?
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
I actually don't think that's going to change. I would be very surprised if at DC ever changed that because it's one of those, like, it's sort of become like a uniquely DC thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I don't know. I would be a little bit surprised if that changed.
You had me read Multiversity, which was really good. Does that story put out during the New 52?
Yes.
Okay. Even going through Rebirth, this is still the multiverse that's in place right now, correct?
I don't think what's interesting with so one of the really interesting things from Multiversity is how much of it has sort of just continued to carry over. Like we've seen the universes and some of the concepts that are introduced in this, and actually were introduced in some of those ideas are introduced during Final Crisis, that group of heroes, multiversal heroes, and then the Monitor. I can't think of his name.
Nix, Utah Nix. Or Nix Yuton? Something like that. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Anyway, he's like a lot of those ideas are introduced in Final Crisis. And it's clear that Morrison was still really interested in that idea. And it sort of carries over. I really think that Multiversity is sort of like the next logical thing that you read. If you read Final Crisis and you enjoy it enough, you maybe are a little bit confused by it. I suggest reading Multiversity next because in a lot of ways it's sort of like the spiritual sequel to it. Not necessarily the direct plot, but like a lot of the like multiverse ideas kind of continue on in Multiversity. But then again, even after this book, we've seen it in our own podcast, we've seen it pop up in Tomasi's Superman run. Scott Snyder's Justice League idea of the multiverse is very, very clearly based off of this. I think we literally see them use the map of the multiverse that is introduced in this. I think it's the best thing. Ultimately, one of the things that this book was meant to do was sort of like Grant Morrison was essentially writing the pilots for different series and being like, look, this is an interesting thing you could do with the multiverse, right? Here's a story where it's about Overman and the Nazi Superman. And here's a story with that. That's something interesting you could do. That's sort of what the point of Multiversity was. It was almost like a collection of pilots in a sense. But I think the lasting legacy of it actually is the multiverse guidebook.
Yes, I found that.
It's fascinating, and it goes through the multiverse. And I think at some point it will become outdated to a certain extent, but it's such a good blueprint and basic guideline for how the multiverse works that it's going to be a long time. It's like, I honestly think like at least a decade or two, if not more, before they rehash this, because it's so well done. And it's one of the things that Morrison does well with this is he intentionally leaves some of them blank. Like, he doesn't define every single 52 universes. Some of them, there's nothing with them, which is perfect, right? It's because that leaves room, because then somebody 10 years from now can do a story with one of those blank multiverses and they're not changing anything. That's not a change to the blueprint. They're just adding details that didn't exist before.
One of the things I liked about that book was, of course, he has the map of the multiverse there, but he also goes into depth with each Earth. You know, nothing with the blank ones, of course, but the other ones, he tells you what characters and stuff are on there. It's pretty interesting. It's just a short overview, but I really found it fascinating.
Yeah, and again, some of it is already a little outdated. Like, for example, their Earth 2 is based on the New 52 Earth 2 book, which is really good. And I guess I'll go ahead and get into that now. But so during the New 52, they actually had what do you do with the JSA? You've rebooted the New 52. The whole point was to basically modernize the DC universe and sort of reintroduce them to have started to exist in the 2000s instead of starting to exist in the 50s. So what do you do with the JSA? If you can't have them still have debuted in the 1940s because they would be geriatric. And so not necessarily the right decision, I don't know, but I found the series interesting. What they decided to do instead was a young JSA set on Earth 2, and it's I found it to be a really interesting series because it's all of the like JSA members but completely reimagined within this world, and you end up with the Black Superman, who's the descendant of Zod. So he's not an L, he's a Zod. You have a different take on Jay Garrick Flash, where he gets his speed from Hermes, the god, instead of some sort of scientific experiment. You have like a different version of Hot Girl. Lois Lane becomes the Red Tornado. So you get all these really interesting takes on it, and it's also, I think, somewhat unique book within the history of DC books, because it's an ongoing book set in a different universe. Like, most of this multiverse stuff that we're talking about, most of the time it only applies in events, or it's in a book that's primarily set in the DC main universe, Earth 1 or 0, whatever, depending on which continuity we're talking about. And it's them going to a different Earth. So, for example, a book that we reviewed would have been Young Justice, right? That is very much an Earth 0 book, but is them going to other Earths. Earth 2, I think, is somewhat unique in that it is a book that is actually set in almost entirely about Earth 2. It is, you know what I mean? It's not about the New 52 Superman going to Earth 2. It's just that Earth. And it's also precipitated by the same event. So the New 52 era, so to speak, the origin of that Justice League is Darkseid invading Earth. And that's sort of what causes the Justice League to form. And they sort of made that the case for other Earths as well. He invades Earth 2. And those versions of Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman are killed. And that leads to the creation of this new JSA. And so it's kind of interesting. So they kind of take that concept of Darkseid invades, and it looks different in this Earth because that's what happens here, is this one. Or it looks different in the main New 52 world because the JLA forms. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. I found a lot of these characters from these different Earths to be cool. One of them is Calvin Ellis, the black Superman who's also the President of the United States. I think it would be interesting to have a miniseries on a look at that character. When I was reading Multiversity, I was fascinated by his character and wanted to know more about his background. Because with that storyline, we just get little tidbits of, from each of these different Earths. And it doesn't do a deep delve into the story, their backstories.
He's gotten, it's, I agree with you, he's an interesting character that we've only ever kind of gotten piecemeal stuff with. So he first pops up. I strongly recommend, if you've either read one or the other, to read both. If you've read Multiversity, I strongly recommend you read Final Crisis, because you see those ideas pop up there first, and one of which is that Black Superman. You see him first pop up in Final Crisis, especially during the Superman parts of the story, because it sort of deals with within that. At one point, Superman is sort of going to different multiverses to recruit the Superman from each Earth, and one of them he goes there, and it's, you know, the Black President Superman. It's cool. I agree with you. It's really cool stuff. And he was one, I'm almost positive he was in the Tomasi story that we read.
I can't remember what story popped it up in, but I remember him popping up before and us talking about him briefly.
I'm like 99% sure he was in the Tomasi story. The journey through the multiverse in Multiversity is so cool. And but like you said, it's a little bit frustrating. At the same time, it is telling sort of an overarching story, but like I said, it is also very much doing like essentially pilots for different series, one of which is a Shazam story that's really cool, Thunderworld. And it's sort of frustrating because you read those like, ooh, this is really good. Somebody should pick this up, and they didn't.
I know, Thunderworld was awesome. I really liked that part of the story, and it's sad that we haven't seen that again, because we got a different version with Geoff Johns. Not saying that his version is bad. It's interesting to see this Thunderworld, and I like the fact that he was actually calling him Captain Marvel.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Thunderworld is basically like your old school classic pre-DC owned Captain Marvel stuff. It would be interesting to see somebody pick some of that up. I like some of the stuff that Geoff Johns has reimagined. But there's some cool stuff I think that you could be doing from old school Shazam also, or Captain Marvel.
I agree. And I found that Dr. Savannah that was obsessed with Mary Marvel, I found him creepy.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Another character I was really interested in was the Abin Sur, who looks like the devil, and that society of superheroes that's led by Dr. Fate. That world looked interesting to me too.
And it was complemented by like the perfect art style too. I totally agree with you. It was really, really interesting. That was one that we saw. I think we've seen that Green Lantern twice. I think he popped up in the Tomasi story, I believe. And then we definitely saw him in, Morrison used him in the season one.
Yeah, that's right. That's where I saw him. I couldn't remember where I'd seen him before. That was it.
I'm so glad that you've read this now, because some of these things that I was referencing, that you've actually read these now too. Oh, man. There was one I wanted to mention that was an interesting concept. Oh, I believe you had read this issue before, because I had recommended it, but the Watchmen, basically Morrison's version of Watchmen.
Right.
That's fascinating. And
yeah, that was...
the name of the issue is called, but it is... It's phenomenal.
Yeah, because that focused a lot on the question.
Pax America. So one of the issues in this, and so another one of, at least in Morrison's version of the multiverse, which DC is still continuing to follow, one of the different universes is basically his version of Watchmen. So again, I'm assuming most of our audience knows a lot of this information. For if you don't know, Watchmen, if you know what Watchmen is, we're going to assume that you know what that comic is. If you don't know this, a lot of the characters in that were meant to be DC characters, like The Question or Blue Beetle.
Right, the old Charleston characters.
Exactly, yes. And they had just recently acquired the rights to those characters, and they hadn't really done anything with them yet. And Alan Moore came up with this story, and initially had the okay to do it, and then I don't know, at some point DC looked at it and was like, maybe let's not. Because once you do that story, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, right?
Right.
Like, you can't make the question anything else after that, or Blue Beetle anything else after that. So Pax Americana is very good. But it basically is those Charlton version of those characters. So it is Captain Atom. It is Blue Beetle. It's really good. It's by far the best issue in the series. I cannot, if you only read one issue of Multiversity, let's say you don't want to get the collection, maybe you want to just check one of the issues out digitally, it's Pax Americana. It's so good.
All right. Other characters I found interesting in this multiverse, Big Baby. I was like, okay, there's DC's version of the Hulk.
Yep.
There was a Green Lantern who could raise the dead. Thought that was interesting. She had one of those, she had like a staff with an old-time lantern on it. We also had an Earth where the Amazons were in charge, so you had like a Woman's Justice League. Thought that was pretty cool. I noticed we had a Batman Beyond universe and a Kingdom Come universe in that. We had also had a Bizarro World and a Superman Red Sun. Captain Carrot. Now there's a character.
another one of the universes that they detail in the Multiverse Guide that doesn't get touched on within Multiversity, the book, is Earth 3. And we talked about, so the first time we ever see Earth 3 is the second ever crisis. And it's the Crime Syndicate. I've mentioned this book before, but it's so good. The most modern version of the Crime Syndicate you can read in a book called Forever Evil. And it was set in continuity. It was during Geoff Johns' run on the Justice League. So this is New 52 era. And the Crime Syndicate, basically their world is dying, and they essentially temporarily successfully invade the main New 52 Earth and take over. And it's sort of up to villains like Lex Luthor and Sinestro and Black Adam to team up and take down the Crime Syndicate because the Justice League is out of commission.
That sounds really interesting.
It's so, if you like villains like I do, I know you don't, but like, it's so good. It is it's like the dream book for fans of DC villains. It's a dream book. It's so good. Because it's like, For me personally, like my personal taste, like the team that takes on the Crime Syndicate is almost like a list of my favorite DC villains. Like you had Lex, you had Sinestro, Black Adam, Captain Cold, Black Manta, Deathstroke. Like it's a who's who's of DC villains. And they team up and take out the Crime Syndicate, who themselves I find very fascinating. It's like this twisted version of you know, the Justice League. It's a great book. Again, it's one of those things. I think the New 52, one of the things I think it did well, there was a lot of things I think they did poorly, but one thing I thought they did well was the idea of the multiverse, because there was actually, now that I'm thinking about it, another book that was sort of about both Earths was, so I talked about Earth 2, right, in the origin of that New 52 Earth 2.
Right.
The Trinity dies. They're in that version, Batman's daughter, Helena, escapes and becomes Huntress. And also, and then Power Girl. So you get Huntress and Power Girl. Like, so you have the explanation of how you have Supergirl and Power Girl, but they come from that specific Earth 2. And then the main, I believe most of the series was set in, you know, Earth 0 or Earth 1 or whatever they wanted to call it. I think that was one thing that the New 52 did do well, was that it actually really dealt with, it felt like it was about a multiverse much more so than I think other eras of DC.
All right. Another character that I think looked interesting, I'd like to see more stories on, is the Bruce Wayne that's Earth's Green Lantern.
I believe that's a Elseworlds.
Is it?
I'm almost positive that's an Elseworlds story.
Man, I'd like to read that story. I'll have to do a search and see if I can find it.
That's another thing that DC has done Well, the Elseworlds thing, and Marvel sort of has their thing with the what ifs, which is also a fascinating concept. But the Elseworlds is one of those things. It's DC's legacy of different Earths and different stories. It's something I'd like to see them bring back. And we've seen them, like, in a sense, they're sort of doing it with these standalone series that we've been reading. But, man, wouldn't it be great to bring Elseworlds back?
Yeah, it would be. I'm surprised they haven't yet.
But you have a lot of these multiverses that are listed. Like you mentioned, there's one that's Kingdom Come. There's another that's the New Frontier.
The New Frontier. I remember seeing that artwork style when I was reading Multiversity. I was like, ooh.
There's one that's Red Sun, the Red Sun version. But yeah, I think there's a decent number of these that are based on Elseworlds stuff or concepts that were sort of introduced in other ones. And Grant Morrison basically was like, well, what if that was its own multiverse?
You mean its own universe?
Its own universe.
All right, I got to ask you a question. What Earth 33 is supposed to be the Ultra Comics universe. I don't know. I found that character a little confusing, or that story a little confusing when I was reading it. What exactly was the purpose of that character?
Okay, so the Ultra Comics one is... I talked about Final Crisis is a little hard to understand. One of the things that helped me understand the comic more, the more I reread it, the more I sort of understood the story, the sort of underlying story that Morrison's trying to tell in that. But one of the things that really helped me get that book is there's an actual book that Morrison's written on the history of comics, and in it he briefly talks about Final Crisis. But one of the things that really affected him personally as a reader growing up was there's an old Silver Age version or issue of The Flash where on the cover, The Flash is telling the reader, I think it's either you need to buy this book, or I won't, I need you to buy this book to help me, survive or help win this or something. And he found that idea so fascinating that the book was almost like telling you to, it was going on a different level of inviting you into the story, where it was like actively making you a part of the story. And so you see that idea really sticks with him. And that's what, the cover of Ultra Comics is clearly that. It's that idea, right? But it's the opposite of that. It's Ultraman telling you, don't read this comic. It's going through the whole thing with Multiversity is really a metafictional thing where a comic book itself is what's sort of causing this, everything to be going on.
Right.
And so it's one of those things. I think it's fair to be frustrated with this if you haven't read some of that stuff. It's one of those things where, the more Morrison stuff you read, the more it all sort of makes sense because you see these ideas explored more. This issue, in my opinion, it's his full exploration of that idea of, I'm fascinated by the idea of this Flash comic telling me to read this book. What could I do with that idea? And I feel like that's what this issue basically is. It's a super, super metafictional comic where, the character that we're seeing, Ultra Comics, is we see him in different eras of comics, right?
Right.
Like we see an old school version of him. We see the gritty, bloody early 2000s. I feel like it's the full exploration of that idea of where the line between am I reading a comic or is the you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I don't know. I'm not elaborating very well, but it's really just Morrison playing with that idea of almost making the reader an active part of the story, or making the comic almost like this living thing.
Okay. With you explaining it, that makes more sense what he was trying to do.
I don't know if that helps at all. I know that maybe isn't the most clear thing, but that's really basically what it is. It's just this exploration of Ultraman is essentially just an embodiment of a comic, the idea of comics almost instilled into this actual superhero.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
That's the thing with a lot of Morrison stuff. His Green Lantern run hasn't really done a ton with that, but a lot of Final Crisis and then Multiversity are really that whole idea of they're comics about comics, And if you don't have that context, it does make it make some stuff be a little like Multiversity is much more clear. I think that it's a comic about a comic because it's literally telling you that.
Right. It does tell you that.
But Final Crisis is not nearly as clear that it is a comic about a comic. And so once if you get that context, it really helps the story sort of make sense. Like in Final Crisis, Superman ultimately, like, he's in the he goes in what they call the bleed, and that makes more sense when you know that that's what the name for the gap between panels in a comic is called, the bleed. And so it's, Superman is like literally going like in between the panels, like the space in between the multiverse. In between the different universes of the multiverse is the bleed. Is basically like, it's more so in that idea of like what's going on in between each panel. It's this almost like this other world. It's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, sounds like it. All right. Anything else you'd like to say about the multiverse before we wrap?
It should be very clear from my gushing on this. It's the best thing about the DC universe. I think it has a lot of great sort of what you would consider to be legacies, so to speak. Like the idea of legacy heroes, I think, is something DC has always, at least used to do really well, and has sort of begun to bring that process back. And the multiverse, I feel like those are two, obviously the Trinity, but you know what I mean? Like, apart from actual heroes, the two big things I think that the DC, you could really, you know, pinpoint what is the DC universe all about. Those are two major things. And I just have always been fascinated by just not only the idea of the multiverse that DC has, but the way that they explore it. Like we've talked about, this isn't just something that they've done recently. Like, yeah, we focused on multiversity, but they've been doing it all the way back in the 50s. And it's just something that they've continued, and they've gone, you know, different stories have gone into different depths with it. I'm sure there are other great multiverse stories that I don't even know about. Like, I only really, my expertise is stuff of comics when I was alive for the most part. So, you know, like, I just, in a lot of ways, that's one of the things when people ask me what about, you know, superhero comics specifically I enjoy so much. It's usually one of the things they talk about is sort of this idea of like, not only do I find, like, obviously I just like superhero stories, right? But I also love the idea that DC has where they just explore, like, well, we have these characters, but, like, there are also so many different interesting things that you can do with the character. Maybe it doesn't make sense to have it be the main version of the character, but why not still tell that story anyway?
You know, DC's missing an opportunity here with not having, like, an Elseworlds ongoing where they focus on, you could focus every issue on one of these different worlds or characters.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to mention Earth 2, is because at least at one point they were trying to do a multiverse thing, and I think it only ever sold like okay, and then towards the end it didn't sell very well. But I agree with you. And then Multiversity, right? The entire point of this comic, like, yes, again, like I said, it's very much Grant Morrison exploring the idea of comics itself while telling these stories. But it's also, he's pitching different, basically, pilot series. Like, it's basically him writing an issue one of a Shazam book, or he's writing an issue, the one of, like, millennial version of the kids of Superman and Batman. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
like,
I know what you mean.
Those are all meant to be like an interesting story that you could do something with, and they've done nothing with it. Nobody picked any of them up. No, I shouldn't say read. You know what I mean? But like, nobody, no writer ever would like, okay, I'm accepting your challenge to write a story with this. Nobody's really done it.
Yeah, that's sad.
Which is why I got so excited when Tomasi at least did a little bit something. In his Superman run, it was like an acknowledgement that Multiversity happened. It was like, oh, hey, nice.
I think one of the things we need to mention, that Earth 10, which is Earth X, that made it onto television with the crossover.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of the crossover. Oh, Crisis on Earth X. You know, even some of the stuff has made it into the television shows.
I have to say, that is one thing the Arrowverse has done really well, was the concept of the multiverse, which obviously, true to Crisis on Earth history, on Infinite Earth history, they've gotten rid of, but I'm sure it's not the end of it.
I'm sure it's not either. Well, it's going to be brought back at some point, I think. And I'm actually looking forward to it when it does.
Well, and what's fascinating, and we talked about this, is that they, even within the show, they acknowledge, like, those characters aren't aware that there's a multiverse, but the show itself acknowledges that there is indeed still a multiverse.
Yeah. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mentioned them so frequently. I strongly recommend, I really personally feel like you should read both, because I feel like they are intrinsically tied together. It doesn't... Final Crisis, I think, is a good story. Definitely not as well received as like Infinite Crisis was before it. But he's clearly not done exploring the ideas in that, and he really kind of brings those to fruition in Multiversity. And likewise, I think as good as Multiversity is on its own, it's made even better if you read Final Crisis. So I strongly recommend. It can potentially be expensive if you're trying to buy the trades, because they are both kind of big, but... if you can, I really strongly recommend both Final Crisis and Multiversity.
All right. And for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about the Earth Station 1 episode 530. The crew there did an episode on remembering Denny O'Neill, and they kind of did a deep dive into his career. So I found that really interesting. So I suggest if you want to learn more about Denny O'Neill, check out their episode. All right. If you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we have a lot of comics. Next week, we have Batman, Detective Comics, Justice League, Justice League Odyssey, Lois Lane, Superman, The Green Lantern Season 2, The Terrifics, Wonder Woman, Young Justice, and of course, Stargirl and Doom Patrol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.